uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, Radio WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org. Welcome to our program. Absolute paper flying all over the place here. We're going to talk about Justice Sunday in just a moment. But first, I wanted to point out to you that if you go to MoveOn.org right now, www.MoveOn.org, you can find out where the Candlelight Vigil is going to be near you. The Candlelight Vigil is tonight in support of Cindy Sheehan. What's going on with Cindy Sheehan? You know, supporting her and supporting just the idea of, hey, how about giving peace a chance? I mean, we're kind of back to the idea on my morning show just a few minutes ago, somebody called and said, we don't want to repeat Vietnam here with these vigils. No, we don't want to repeat Vietnam with this quagmire. I think it's entirely appropriate that we be standing up and saying, enough. We tried to prevent this thing. You know, the largest demonstrations literally in the history of the world. People standing up and speaking out to try and stop the war from happening. And that didn't work. And so now, you know, hey, let's stop the killing. Might be a good idea. I'm, you know, strongly of the opinion that we've reached the point now where we are more of an irritation in Iraq than we are a solution. That we're creating more of a problem than we are any kind of solution at all. And we really need to be doing something about this. Cindy Sheehan has an ad playing right now in Crawford, Texas. Here's a quick clip from it.
My name is Cindy Sheehan. Mr. President, my name is Cindy Sheehan. On April 4, 2004, my son Casey was killed in Iraq. He was only 24, and he died in his best friend's arms. Casey was so good and so honest. Why can't you be honest with us? You are wrong about the weapons of mass destruction. You are wrong about the link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. You lied to us. And because of your lies, my son died. You said he died for a noble cause. What cause? Mr. President, I want to tell you face to face how much this hurts. I love my country, but how many more of our loved ones need to die in this senseless war? How many more soldiers have to die before we say enough? I know you can't bring Casey back, but it's time to admit mistakes and bring our troops home now.
There you go. That's Cindy Sheehan in Crawford, Texas. An ad that is actually playing in the local TV stations. Oddly enough, when I saw it being played on some of the national news programs yesterday, they just clipped the last few segments, the little pieces of it. They didn't take the part where she says, you lied us into a war. You know, surprise, surprise. But anyhow, that's what happened. Eric McFadden is with us. Eric is with Catholics for Faithful Citizenship. And Eric, you had some... welcome to the program, first of all.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
I'm very pleased to have you with us, Eric. Justice Sunday 2 just happened, and it seems that we all got treated to Mr. William Donahue of the Catholic League representing himself as the world's representative of Catholics or something. You are Catholic. What was your take on that?
Well, we were extremely disappointed that Justice Sunday 2 didn't have any credible Catholic voice at Justice Sunday 2. William Donahue is far from that. There's even been bishops that have spoken out as to how they could tame William Donahue and tone down his rhetoric, because he really doesn't speak on behalf of Catholics. He's very bombastic.
How did he become president of the Catholic League?
Well, we're not sure, but we're looking into that. I think it has a lot to do with money. The Catholic League's pretty much propped up by large donors through the Heritage Foundation.
Well, a better question for those of us who are not Catholic, what is the Catholic League?
Well, the Catholic League was founded in 1973, interestingly enough, by a Jesuit. And Jesuit thinking is far, it's completely on the opposite side of where William Donahue stands.
The Jesuits, in other words, tend to be more progressive in their thinking?
Yes, and the Catholic League was founded to combat bigotry and, civil rights for Catholics, anti-Catholic views. And they've done a good job over that over the years. But then enter William Donahue, who has turned the Catholic League into an organization to use as a vehicle to promote his political agenda.
Yeah, I understand that he was his speech was full of accusations and threats. What, for example?
Well, I mean, he started out by bashing Irish Catholics and kind of lumping
Irish. Wait a second, isn't he an Irish Catholic?
Pardon?
Isn't he an Irish Catholic?
Yes, I'm an Irish Catholic as well, and he kind of lumped all Irish Catholics in with Ted Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy is a Catholic himself.
Right, and Irish Catholic at that.
Yeah, and then he started bragging about how he perceives himself as a threat, as if threatening others is somehow compatible with Christianity.
A threat to the left.
Yeah, he seems to be real enthralled with the fact that he's out there with his fists up and he's ready to fight, if somehow that's Catholic or Christian.
Jesus had his righteous indignation with the money changers in the temple, but I think that was pretty much it. Most of his teaching was devoted to variations on turn the other cheek and care for the hungry and the poor, was it not?
Well, yeah, and feed the poor, clothe the naked, shelter the homeless.
Yeah, Matthew 25.
Yeah.
The great command, as it were.
I don't think Mr. Donahue may not have read Matthew since Sunday school when he was a child. I'm not sure, but and then he went on to talk about and quote a famous atheist and Marxist, Sidney Hook, who he claims had great influence on him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think as a great Catholic leader that he proclaims to be, Donahue would reference, a pope, a cardinal, a bishop, maybe even a priest. But he chooses an atheist Marxist.
That's remarkable. We're talking with Eric McFadden. He's with the Catholics for Faithful Citizenship. Is there a website, by the way, for your group, Eric?
Yes, it's CatholicsForFaithfulCitizenship.org.
That makes perfect sense. Catholics, F-O-R, FaithfulCitizenship.org. And I met Pope John Paul II and at his summer castle in Castel Gandolfo. I had a brief conversation with him, shook his hand. Spent about an hour and a half sitting relatively next to him. I was sitting about 20 feet away from him with a bunch of other people, and then had this brief private audience with him. And I got it when I met him. This was about, 8 years ago or so. I got it that this was a very, very, very powerful man, not just politically powerful, but a guy who just had steel in him. And, believed what he believed and was just not going to be stopped by anything. And he was outspokenly opposed to the American invasion of Iraq.
He certainly was.
Why is that fact? I mean, it wasn't like he just said, oh, gee, it's not a good idea. I mean, he was outspokenly opposed to it. And that fact is absolutely known to every citizen of Europe. I mean, there's not an Italian who doesn't know that Pope John Paul II, begged George Bush not to attack Iraq and or ordered him to or whatever. I don't know what the appropriate word would be, but, just came right out and said it repeatedly. Why is that not widely known in the United States? I'll bet most Catholics don't know that.
I would say a majority of Catholics know it. It's just that those on the right have spent so much time, money, and effort in shaming Catholics into being silent on some of these issues.
But you've got the Catholic perspective on birth control and on abortion that is absolutely ascendant in these circles. Everybody knows how the Pope thought about, stem cell research, and everybody knows what the Pope thinks about abortion. Nobody knows about what the Pope thinks about the war in Iraq?
It's interesting. I mean, I witnessed a priest get up in front of a parish and give a pro-war sermon right when the war started, if you can believe that.
You're kidding.
That's the kind of infiltration the right has on the American Catholic Church.
Did not the priest know that he was speaking against his own pope?
Oh, I'm sure he did. He had to have.
That's an okay thing to do?
The UN even spoke out against it last November.
Yeah.
At the United Nations, or it was October or November when they spoke out against it once again. I mean, it's an ongoing thing. It's just like anything else with conservative Catholics on the right, on the extreme right, like William Donahue. They want to take their message and get that across to people, and even if it comes to Pope John Paul, they will dilute his message, set him aside, and put their own message in there. And in this case, they turn to Catholic teaching on just war doctrine and somehow try to twist that in their favor.
Eric McFadden of Citizens for Faithful Catholics for Faithful Citizenship. Eric, just one quick last question. I have not seen any of the level of outspokenness which came out of John Paul II from the new pope, from formerly Mr. Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict. Do you have any thoughts on where he stands on these issues? Is the official doctrine of the Church continuing, even though the papacy has changed?
Where is
the Catholic Church going on this?
That Pope Benedict would have a stand against this war. He has not really spoken out on it. I'm kind of hoping that at World Youth Day in Germany, which is kind of puts him on the world stage for the first time,
mm-hmm.
that we'll hear something from him in regards to it.
Yeah, and that's coming up fairly soon, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I believe it started today.
Oh, okay.
But it's underway. I think he's due there this weekend. But expecting large crowds welcoming him back to Germany. So.
Okay. Great. Eric McFadden, thank you so much for being with us, Eric.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
I appreciate it. CatholicsForFaithfulCitizenship.org is Eric's website. And, their response to Justice Sunday, too, they think it is rather Injustice Sunday. A couple of other interesting little bits of news. The only newspaper that George W. Bush will read is the Washington Times. Of course, the Washington Times, the only newspaper that Reagan would read, the only newspaper in Washington, D.C. that a lot of right-wingers will read. The Washington Times, of course, owned by Reverend Moon, and still operating at a loss as far as I know. I may be wrong, but the last I heard, they were still operating at a loss. I think Reverend Moon has lost almost $1 billion on this thing. In any case, here, this from the Japanese news service KCNA. Leader Kim Jong-il, this is the leader of North Korea, received Ju Dong-mun, president of the Washington Times Corporation, on a visit to Pyongyang. On the occasion, the president of the Washington Times Corporation offered his congratulations to Kim Jong-il on the 60th anniversary of Korea's liberation. Kim Jong-il welcomed the Pyongyang visit of the president of the Washington Times Corporation, had a cordial talk with him, and posed for a photograph with him. Can you imagine if the publisher of the New York Times or the Washington Post had gone over to North Korea on the 60th anniversary of the liberation, in quotes, of North Korea, and shook hands with Kim Jong-il and congratulated him on the liberation of his nation? Can you imagine how the right wing would be dealing with that? I mean, they wouldn't just be frantically, hysterically going on and on and on about, you know, things like they are with Able Danger today, which we'll get into a little later on. They'd be burning down buildings over this. And my guess is that because of the Washington Times, it's not even going to be mentioned in the American media. I mean, I had to get this from a Japanese news service. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If it makes you happy, it can't be that bad.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And from outside the country, you can call 503-248-0620. And Able Danger, I'm telling you, this is going to be the right-wing hysteria point today, because during the last couple of years of the Clinton administration, the Department of Defense discovered that Mohammed Atta was in the United States along with his merry band, or at least a few of them, and that these guys were connected to Al-Qaeda. And they didn't tell the FBI. That's a terrible thing. But the other half of the story that I guarantee the right-wingers are not going to tell you is that but they are going to point on that, because it happened while Bill Clinton was president, that during the Bush administration, last year, when the 9/11 Commission was looking into this, Congress directed the Defense Department, Don Rumsfeld's Defense Department, the Able Danger folks, to disclose 100% of their information to the 9/11 Commission. That part that was secret could be disclosed in secret. These folks all had security clearances, you know, quack, quack, quack. And they still didn't do it. This guy who came out and spoke out now is being spun by the right wing as if he's speaking out against the Clinton administration. Actually, his concern is that during the Bush administration, this information still didn't get out. This is a problem that goes beyond politics. It's not about right or left or which administration is in power. It's about the Defense Department being out of control in this regard. And something that I think we ought to pay attention to, but not, frankly, in a political way. It's something that is systemic and hopefully will get, you know, appropriate concern. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Mike in a truck in Florida on the line. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? I was calling about the price of fuel, how I see it catching up on the people.
Yeah.
When I go down the highway, I've been seeing a lot of cars that run out of gas. And it's the guy who works at like KFC, you know, where he's not making a real good living there. And, you know, my friend, he works there at KFC, and, you know, when he gets done filling up his tank, he can't afford to buy food, so he's got to go to the church, you know, to get food, you know. So it's
What you're seeing here, Mike, is the logical result of 25 years of conservative economic policies. I mean, the impoverishment of the American middle class, the destruction of our manufacturing base, the exporting of all of our jobs and our industries, all for the benefit of large multinational corporations who are big donors to the Republicans, and all at the expense of the average person. And by the way, there's no shortage of Democrats, by the way, who have their hand in that pot as well. The Democratic
right.
Leadership Council being the main representatives of them, the Joe Lieberman wing of the party, as it were. But this is, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, when I was a teenager 30 years ago, more or less, a job at KFC was something that you did as a teenager. In fact, my first job when I was like 13 or 14 was at Henry's Hamburgers, flipping burgers. And,
right.
You know, that was an entry-level job. It wasn't expected that, you know, people in the real workforce got those kind of jobs. I mean, I did that. I was a waiter. I worked in a gas station. You do these things to put yourself through school, and you could actually put yourself through college back in those days, by the way, with those kinds of jobs. And now the college costs are out of sight. The actual decent jobs are gone. We've exported, just since Bush became president, a couple of million manufacturing jobs. And now, and in addition to that, Jimmy Carter was the last president to have an actual energy policy. And so, you know, the price of oil is through the roof. The price of gasoline is through the roof. The price of gasoline, by the way, is not just going up because oil is going up. It's going up because the oil companies are simply charging us more for it. And they're making the biggest profits in the history of the industry. They're making bigger profits than they were when John Rockefeller was leading the robber barons.
So, right, right.
So there you go, Mike. I mean, you know, thanks for the call and for pointing it out. That is the problem. I mean, that absolutely is what's going on. And it's just you're seeing the logical outcome of the kind of policies brought to you, thank you very much, brought to you by Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton in his trade policies with NAFTA and GATT, and let us not forget it, and you know, keep the eye out on those DLC Democrats who say that they are speaking for the Democratic Party when they're not, the Democratic Leadership Council, and, of course, George W. Bush, this so-called conservative economic policies. We had the golden age of the American middle class in the 1940s to the 1980s, where one person working full-time could raise a family, put their kids through school, have health care and a pension. It's all gone now, ever since Reagan came into office. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. A joint Chinese and Russian military exercise is set to begin tomorrow. And one U.S. official quoted in the Washington Times, an article by Bill Gertz, says, for the Chinese and the Russians, this is a message to the United States. They want to see our bases in Central Asia and presence in Asia cut back. Gertz notes, the fact that the United States was not invited to observe the war games is a sign of the anti-U.S. nature of the exercises, said several officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Defense officials from India, Iran, Pakistan, and Mongolia will be present in China to observe the exercises, but they didn't invite us. They call this Peace Mission 2005, 10,000 Russian and Chinese troops. Because, notes the Washington Times, because China defines terrorism as including separatists, U.S. intelligence officials think the exercises are directed at Taiwan, which Beijing views as a breakaway province, and at the United States, which has vowed to protect Taiwan from mainland attack. Well, what's happening is that China is now starting to compete with the United States for oil. China just signed a huge contract with Iran to buy Iran's oil. The United States is talking about bombing Iran. The Russians are not at all happy with the situation in Iraq. They had signed a deal with Saddam Hussein for his oil. We now have his oil. The Chinese are saying, hey, you're going to do in Iran what you to us, what you did to the Russians in Iraq? And here we have just, you know, 2 months ago, maybe not even that long ago, a Chinese general comes out and says, we will drop nuclear missiles on over 100 American cities if you try to stop us from taking Taiwan. And at the highest levels, our diplomats went to China and said, is this guy nuts? Is he some renegade general? He was not punished. The government didn't come out and say, oh, yes, we will bomb you. But they didn't come out and retract his statement either. They just let it stand. And in diplomatic speak, everybody in the State Department knows what that means. Again, very little press coverage in the United States. Why? It would make Walmart look bad. It would make George Bush look bad. Because they're doing nothing about this. Walmart is selling us, not just Walmart, in general, we're being sold down the tubes by this, by these policies, by these trade policies, these crazy trade policies. Rebecca from Louisville, Kentucky is on the line. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hello. What I'm wondering is why it would not be possible for us as Americans to hold the energy companies' feet to the fire, just as they have done with the electric company in California just this past week. They're having to pay back the people that they gouged during their energy crisis.
Yeah.
Can we not do the same thing?
Yeah, the theory behind that is that when you have a monopoly in existence, then you can suspend the rules or modify the rules of just raw capitalism for a moment. You know, I mean, the basic, have you ever played Monopoly, Rebecca?
Certainly.
You remember the game? In that game, the goal is to wipe out everybody else and end up owning everything. And one person eventually will end up owning everything in Monopoly. And so thus you create a monopoly. Well, with electric power, it's really obviously a monopoly. There's only one power grid that's coming into a neighborhood. And so you can't select from different competing electric companies. And so, you know, historically in the United States, there's been a consensus. There's been a shared opinion that, well, these are monopolies, and therefore they should either be run by local municipalities or states, that is, agencies that are responsible to, and can be fired by we the people, can be voted out, or if they're going to be in private hands, that they have to be very, very heavily regulated utilities. And that's why historically the private utility sector was, you know, a very safe place to invest money, because we'd never get a huge return, but you'd make a loss, because the regulations say, you know, we're going to guarantee you a profit. In exchange for that, you're going to have to do all these things. And so, you know, regulating electricity is a bit of a no-brainer, although, you know, there's a lot of cons running around saying electricity shouldn't be regulated. Here in Portland, where I am, PGE was bought by Enron. It's owned by Enron right now. And the city of Portland is agonizing over whether they should use eminent domain to take it back, and it looks like they're not going to, which I think is a shame. But in any case, that sort of thing is happening all around the country, those debates. But when it comes to the oil companies, where you can drive your car to five different gas stations that get their oil from five different oil companies, you don't have that perception of monopoly. Now, there is a reality of monopoly. There's, you know, only a half a dozen or so oil companies, major oil companies, operating in the United States. And as I pointed out, the price, and in fact, I learned this from a front page story in the Wall Street Journal about 2 months ago, the price of gasoline has gone up much faster than the price of oil has gone up. The oil companies are charging us much more for gasoline than they need to simply recover the cost of the increased cost of a barrel of oil. But there really is kind of this broad perception in America that there's nothing that we can do about it in terms of regulation. Nixon tried doing this with wage and price controls, you know, and also saying, okay, you can only buy gas on alternate days depending on whether your license plate was odd or even, and all that kind of stuff, back during the oil crisis in the 70s. and it was a spectacular disaster. And generally, that kind of intervention in the marketplace is a disaster. The appropriate way to do it would be to do it the way that the United States did in 1881, actually, when John Rockefeller was doing the same thing. He had started the Standard Oil Company of Ohio. He turned it into a trust, into a giant monopoly, bought up all these other oil companies, and drove his competition out of business. And so and then all of a sudden the price of oil, mostly kerosene, you know, heating oil and lamp oil, the price of kerosene started going through the roof because he was price gouging. And so the states got together, or, you know, the federal government. Senator Sherman from Ohio, in fact, introduced the bill in December of 1881, the Sherman Antitrust Act, and said it's illegal for any company to get so big that it can control the marketplace like that. And Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act for all practical purposes, and it hasn't been enforced since then. And that's why during the 8 years of Reagan's presidency, there was this mergers and acquisitions mania, you know, the movie that was made about it and all that other stuff, Greed is Good. And you saw all these companies and all these guys who were getting rich, you know, doing M&A deals, you know, mergers and acquisitions, as the bigger got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and we ended up with our media being controlled by a small number of companies, our fuel sources being controlled by a small number of companies, and you know, our on and on. On and on it went. And it's not a healthy thing. So I think the appropriate way to respond to it, rather than to saying to the oil companies, you can't charge us this much profit, would be to say, you can't be this big, and start breaking them up. But it's not going to happen in a Republican presidency, Rebecca.
Well, that's unfortunate, because yeah. They have been making these record profits, and somehow I think that some of that money has to go back to the people. And if we don't at some point stand up and say, you can no longer do this to us, then they're going to continue doing it as long as we permit it.
Absolutely, and that's why it takes the force of we the people collectively to do something about it rather than calling, for example, for a boycott. I remember, you know, a few years ago there was this email that was running around the web about, you know, let's tell ExxonMobil that we don't like their price gouging. Don't buy ExxonMobil for a week and we'll show them. And the people at ExxonMobil are going, yeah, right, okay, cool. Don't buy our product for a week. What's going to happen? Your car's going to run out of gas. You know, they know that we are addicted to their drug, as it were. You know, it's like heroin dealers sitting around going, oh, yeah, these guys are going to boycott us for a week. Let's see how it works. So the way to respond is to say, no, we're going to change the rules of the game of business that you guys are playing. And the rules
well,
of the
then
game.
Let's start doing that.
Yeah, we need to. If we just simply started enforcing the Sherman Act, we could solve much of this problem, because then the big oil companies would be broken up into smaller oil companies, and they would actually compete with each other for our business.
Good. Then let's start a movement,
yeah.
Tom.
Well, contact your member of Congress. 1-877-SOB-USOB is the telephone number, the toll-free number for Congress. It really is. It's the old Senate office building number. It's not a published number, but it works. It's 1-877-SOB, the letter U, like in the United States of America, SOB. And just simply ask for your member of Congress and say, hey, listen, we should start breaking up some of these big companies. We should start enforcing the Sherman Act and breaking up big oil, breaking up big media, breaking up, you know, some of these just big, you know, Walmart. The kind of power that some of these corporations have now is just way over the top. Rebecca, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you. Great
to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I'd like to address the problems of the labor unions in the United States today. Your great interviews, history lessons, and rants commenting on the current labor union and economic conditions seem to leave out what I consider to be a very important component of the decline of labor unions in the U.S. Considering that the decline began in the late 50s and was coincidental with McCarthyism, witch hunts, blacklists, and labor purges, the left was purged and crushed and silenced and sidelined. And the labor unions caved to McCarthyism. And
but they weren't the only. I mean, a lot of industries. I mean, look at Hollywood. I mean, a lot of, you had Ronald Reagan in there acting as a spy when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, you know, for J. Edgar Hoover. A lot of people caved. No, Bob, you make a good point, but I think that you're correct in tracing the decline of labor really back to the early 1950s. Actually, it goes back a little before that. It was in 1947. In the election of 1946, the Republicans took the House and Senate, and Harry Truman was president. And they were still angry. The Republicans were still angry that in 1935, when Roosevelt was president, the Wagner Act had been passed, which allowed there to be union shops. Allowed you to have a union shop where the employers, you know, were forced to hire union people, basically. They viewed it as a force, you know, using the government to protect labor. Right. And they had always wanted to undo the Wagner Act. And so in 1947, the Republicans passed through the House and the Senate the Taft-Hartley Bill. And the Taft-Hartley Bill said that an individual state could choose on a statewide basis to opt out of many of the provisions of the Wagner Act. In other words, you could have a state that says, we're not going to go along with federal labor law. And these states, they called them so-called right-to-work states. And really, it was the right to an employer not to have a union, and that's what it was. And Harry Truman vetoed that law, the Taft-Hartley Act. It went back to Congress, and they overrode his veto, and it became law in 1947. And then from 48, 49, there wasn't too much activity as a result of that. By the time the early 50s happened, a lot of the southern states started, because it had to go through their legislatures, they started opting into Taft-Hartley and saying, we're no longer going to be governed entirely by the Wagner Act. We're going to be governed by Taft-Hartley. And those became the so-called right-to-work states, mostly in the South. And as a result of that, then a lot of industry started moving to the South because there they could say, to the unions, they could say, hey, you guys take a hike. And that was the beginning of the softening of the labor union in the United States, the labor movement in the United States. And then Reagan came into office in 1980 and takes on PATCO in late 80 or early 81, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, and busts that union and basically declares war on organized labor. At the time of the Taft-Hartley bill, when Taft-Hartley was passed in 47, 35% of American workers were unionized. And for every union job in America, there's typically one other job that has identical pay and benefits, because union jobs tend to set a local floor and ceiling. They tend to define the local labor market. So that meant that 70% of Americans with one income could raise a family, put their kids through school, have a pension for their retirement, and have all their health care covered, because that was the norm. Those were the norms back then. 70% of Americans. When Reagan came into office, the result of Taft-Hartley, of 20 years of Taft-Hartley, almost 30 years of Taft-Hartley, was that that 35% had gone down to about 25%, which was still, 25% of America unionized, half of America having that you could raise a family in 1980 when Reagan came in. Reagan declared war on organized labor, and between Taft-Hartley and now you've got, the Bush administration has actually stacked the Labor Department with people who hate labor, with anti-labor people. So, they just ruled recently, for example, that an employer can say that it's against the law for you to meet and talk, to fraternize, after hours, which means it's illegal to do union organizing activity. Now we're down to the point where it's about 8 to 9% of the private labor force in the United States. If you include government employees, 12 to 13%, which means that now only about 20% of all workers in the United States, only about 16-18% of all private workplace workers in the United States have a decent salary. And what that is the death of the middle class, nothing more and nothing less.
Well, I think a correlative of this is the fact that today we suffer the results of this purging of the left by liberal and progressive being a pejorative term.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Because we don't have an actual left, so therefore we're not viewed as the center. We're on the left, and most Americans not paying as much attention as someone is concerned.
Okay, so what you're saying is because the Communist Party is no longer active in the United States, there used to be an active Communist Party in the United States in the 40s and 50s even, and because the Communist Party, which is the left, is no longer active, folks like you and me, who would just call ourselves old-fashioned Democrats, FDR liberals, modern word progressives, folks like you and me, instead of being perceived as the center, which it used to be. We used to be, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, before Reagan, we were viewed as the center, and the left was the communists, and the right was the right-wingers, the extremists, the John Birchers, the people like George W. Bush. You're saying because of the purges, the communists, we're now perceived as the left-wingers.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And it's not just the very extreme left like the communists, but not
well, socialists as well, Good, interesting. Good point, Bob.
So
thank
it
you.
Seems to me that the radical center should shelter the radical left.
Here we are, the radical middle. We'll take them in. Bob, I appreciate it. I've got the smartest listeners in the world. I got to tell you that. I really appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Chris in Long Beach, California on the line. Hey, Chris, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Hey. Hi, Tommy or Iraq. I just have a quote from you from Cardinal Ratzinger, new pope.
Yes.
On whether or not Iraq is just war or not.
Oh, great.
And when he was asked if the Iraq war is just, he replied, well, just look at the catechism where it teaches about war, and if you can say it is a just war, then you really don't know the catechism. There is no such thing in Catholic teaching as a preemptive war that could ever be justified. there were not sufficient reasons to unleash a war.
Wow. So that's Cardinal Ratzinger or Bishop Pope Benedict now.
Pope Benedict.
Yeah, that's Pope Benedict's position.
Right.
This is not, repeat, not a just war.
Exactly.
That's remarkable. Well, thank you, Chris, for that. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And good to know that the Catholic Church is continuing with, you know, following the teachings of Jesus. I mean, it's a good idea for, you know, the leading church, the leading Christian denomination to do that. I think it's marvelous. Justice Sunday. Oh, what a sad thing. We opened the program with, of course, this whole good old Bill Donahue out there saying that he's representing the Catholics of America and just spreading anger and hate and saying that he's threatening, the left views him as a threat, and that's a wonderful thing. Oh, yeah, yeah. This is the death of religion. I mean, you know, or hopefully the right wing of it. 10 minutes before the end.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
There is a war between the rich and poor, a war between the man and the woman.
And welcome back, my friends.
There is a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say there is one.
Yeah, perhaps that's the biggest war right now. Thank you, Leonard Cohen. Welcome back to our program. 5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Bill in East Long Island, New York on the line. Hey, Bill, welcome.
Yeah, how you doing? I just wanted to call to let you know, as I already posted on your blog, that I created a forum where if anybody who wants to show their support for Cindy to just write up some kind of a sign in support of her, take a picture and send it into our site, and we'll post it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And they can get to that by going to tomhartman.com and clicking on the message board.
Right. And then the site name was imstandingwithcindysheehan.com, and it's I-M. It does no apostrophe in it.
Right. You can't use apostrophes in a URL. So I am standingwithcindysheehan.com.
Right.
Okay,
right. Right now there's only 3 pictures up there because we just got the thing propagated. So
right.
Anybody who wants to join the forum, and then from there we're going to send it over to Cindy so she can see that there's a lot of people standing behind it that she doesn't even know about.
Great. Good on you, Bill. Good on you. Well done. Thank you very much. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota with us. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, earlier in the hour you mentioned how the corporate media clipped and cut off the part that about lying us into a war.
Yes.
And I've noticed after watching she in a few interviews, I'm impressed how quickly she goes straight to the point, no link between Iraq and 9/11. She gets that out quick, knowing that she only has a soundbite to get it out.
Right.
And she repeats it over and over. And that's the key, because the whole argument for the right rests on linking this war to 9/11. And Democrats supported the war in Afghanistan because that was the link that was connected to Al-Qaeda. And as long as she keeps hammering away, there's no link. Forget the WMD argument. That's,
right. Well, in fact, here's George Bush on it.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
We've had no evidence Saddam Hussein was involved
with September 11th. But the corporate media keeps trying to not mention that, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And the right-wing bloviators, the right-wing talk machine out there, I guess I'm one of them, so I shouldn't make it a pejorative.
Right.
But the right, not a right-winger, but anyhow,
blowhard
here. The right-wingers, you know, they're absolutely trying to conflate 9/11.
Right.
And that's what the Defense Department's trying to do here, is conflate 9/11 in Iraq with this march that they're going to have on 9/11. It's a terrible thing. Tom, thanks for the call and for pointing that out. You're absolutely right. We all need to pay attention to how we use language and be very, very precise and keep pointing out, sorry, no link between 9/11 and Iraq. It's as if we were attacked on Pearl Harbor and we decided to bomb Brazil. I mean, that's what happened. That's how bright this guy is down in Crawford, Texas. Or how demented he is. Or how dangerous he is. And the fact that an entire huge right-wing machine was assembled to confuse the American people about this, truly breathtaking, truly mind-boggling.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. Right here for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Alec Epstein, is with us. Alex is with the Ayn Rand organization. He's a junior fellow with Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Recently, PETA, which is at PETA.org. You can check out the video there and I suppose make up your own mind on this, has filed a complaint with Covenants. Am I pronouncing the company name right, Alex?
I believe it's Covance.
Covance, thank you. With Vienna, Virginia, with the local municipality there, that the Covance, this company, has, to quote from the document, animals with broken limbs deprived of veterinary care and euthanasia, animals found having seizures, animals with oozing open wounds on their legs, animals who had suffered side effects from drugs that left them in conditions that required mercy killings, physical and psychological violence against primates by Covance workers, including sick monkeys jammed forcefully into plastic restraint tubes and terrified monkeys slammed to the floor, sprayed with water, intentionally tortured, and thrown into their cages after having drugs forced into their stomachs, baby monkeys whose noses bled daily because of Covance's failure to use the proper-sized tubes to thread up their noses, down their throats, and into their stomachs to deliver test substances, failure to provide the monkeys with socialization and enrichment, which is required by the AWA, leading to self-mutilation, repetitive behaviors, and it goes on and on and on. You think that this is just a bunch of hooey, that the animals should have no rights. Am I getting the piece that you wrote about this correct?
Oh, well, that's not exactly the issue. I mean, it's certainly true that animals do have no rights, but the point was primarily about the nature of this campaign.
Wait a second. It's true that animals have no rights? Then if you take a dog out on a street and put a gun up to its head and start yelling and screaming, draw some attention, do you think the cops are just going to let you kill it?
Well, that's... That's a bizarre example, but the question is...
Where I got that from was Mad Magazine back in the late 70s. They had a cover where it was a picture of a dog with a guy with a gun to its head, and they said, buy this magazine or we'll shoot this dog. And Mad actually got in trouble for that cover.
Okay, but the issue is not will the police stop you, but should they stop you? We're talking about what is actually...
Well, you said they have no rights. I'm saying they do have rights. You're saying they shouldn't have rights.
Okay, that's being a little semantic, but yes, they in fact, logically, they have no rights, and so the government should not protect any rights of theirs. But
okay, now why should animals have no rights?
No, wait a second. Well, let's use an example here. This is you're talking about abuse of these monkeys, but the real issue at stake here is, do we have a right to use animals to test on? So would you say that we have a right to test monkeys in order to say, find a cure for cancer?
I think within certain limits, we certainly test on humans. I mean, here in Portland, there's a company that runs ads in the newspaper. You can get $400, I believe it's a month, if you take experimental drugs. In one case, we just found that the U.S. EPA does countenance to test on poor people in poor neighborhoods, exposing their children to pesticides, paid them with Sony Walkmans. I mean, so, you know, we're testing on humans within reasonable boundaries. We could test on animals, but torturing animals, inflicting unnecessary pain on them, you know, I think that that's pretty unnecessary, particularly given the fact that we have demonstrated now, and there's a huge body of research on this, that most of the tests that are being done on animals can be done actually more effectively and more efficiently with more accurate results on human tissue culture, on human tissue in culture, in a petri dish.
Okay, but that's greatly exaggerated by the animal rights movement. But whether it's true or not, the issue is, in principle, do we have a right to use animals for research, and to what extent? And as somebody, and if you accept the idea of animal rights, then you have to say at some point we have to sacrifice animal research in the name of preserving rats or monkeys.
Why? If we're saying, hey, humans are animals, And monkeys and dogs and rats are animals, and we have limits on the appropriate and ethical boundaries of testing on humans, and yet we allow testing on humans, including toxic substances being tested on humans. And then why would we not have limits on the testing of on animals? Why not say, hey, you can, you know, it's not appropriate to do testing on animals in ways that cause them great distress, that cause them harm, or that, you know, perhaps I think more appropriately, or that can be done using human tissue culture or other tissue cultures in vitro that don't involve using live creatures. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that it is, first of all, it's you're equating testing humans and testing animals, which is not a legitimate thing to
We're animals, Alex.
Okay. Well,
you don't think we're animals?
Well, we are animals in terms of that as part of, we are that genus, but we are fundamentally different from other animals in a sense that gives us
we're actually in that kingdom. We're in a different genus than most animals, but we're in that kingdom.
Okay, but so to get to your equating between testing humans and testing animals, you don't test humans as in you take somebody and then you violate, as you cannot properly take a child, for instance, and you want to see if a drug is effective and it won't benefit the child at all and you still test it on them. That's not how it works. You test drugs on humans that need them or in a life or death situation where they can afford massive risks.
Not true. I'm sorry, Alex, that's just simply not true.
No, I'm saying that is the proper policy, regardless of whatever thing you can dig up from some horror story. But the issue is, for animals, whereas your attitude toward the animal is, how can we use the animal in the best way to generate the best cure for human beings? And often that involves killing them and testing things that you're pretty sure will kill them, but you find some medical result. So the principle is, my principle is, animals have no rights. You use animals for human benefit. You don't use humans. You don't sacrifice one human to another, but you certainly do use animals to benefit human life. And if you say, well, I want to place limits on that, then you are endorsing the unnecessary death of humans. And that's what animal rights means. It means sacrificing humans to rats.
So your position is that the animal rights movement is cruelty to humans?
Absolutely it is.
Okay. Well, I think we just have a fundamental disagreement. I just don't see it that way. It doesn't make any sense to me what you're saying. It seems to me that there should be a logical middle ground where we say, okay, you know, if there are some things that we need to find out, and at the same time, we need to have respect for all life. You don't think that animals have sentience? You don't think that you think that there's such a huge dividing line between us and, say, our dogs and cats that those dogs and cats should just absolutely have no rights at all?
It's not that they should have no rights. They do have no rights. Rights are an advanced human.
But no, legally they do actually have rights. There are laws against cruelty to animals. Are you suggesting that those laws should be repealed?
Yes, but that's not...
Okay, so that's so really what we're getting to here is your core concept, which is that there's a bright dividing line between human beings and all other members of the kingdom animal, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
The concept of rights only applies to human beings.
Why?
And to apply it to what?
Why?
Why? Because it's where does the idea of rights come from? It's not just, you know, there's no God. It's
well,
not,
Rousseau wrote about it. Locke wrote about it. Thomas Jefferson wrote about it. Jefferson wrote about the natural rights of all living things. In fact, one of the big arguments that Jefferson had with Ben Franklin was that, you know, Ben Franklin was of the opinion that that nature was not democratic, that nature was hierarchical, and that the natural state of humans was hierarchical. And Jefferson was of the opinion that nature was actually democratic, and humans were also innately democratic. And, you know, these guys had this argument about it through their whole lives. It was, you know, kind of a technical point, but just in the last two or three years, we've discovered that Jefferson was right and Franklin was wrong. And Jefferson, when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, viewing nature as all of one seamless living thing, he put nature's God into the Declaration of Independence, and John Adams said, oh no, this should be the Christian God, and Jefferson said, no, I'm not going to compromise on that. It's nature's God. It's all living things.
Okay, well, I'm pretty sure that that's a gross misinterpretation of Jefferson, but whatever Jefferson thought about this issue, rights is a need of human life. If there were no humans around, there would be no concept of rights, nobody to grasp it, nobody to follow it. Rights arises because human beings require the government to do certain things. They need protection from certain things in order to live
and flourish.
Have you ever had
pets, Alex?
Yes, but that
have those pets interacted in a way that seemed respectful towards each other at all, ever?
Have the I think I don't know exactly what that would mean for them to act respectfully toward each other, but they certainly were not grasping an abstract principle. And the point is,
I don't think rights is an abstract principle.
No, hold on. Let me just say, I am an objectivist. I endorse the philosophy of Ayn Rand, which says that the individual should live for his own sake. That's your life that matters.
Right. Selfishness above all else.
What did you say?
Selfishness above all else.
Well, selfishness above all else, but in a human context, you benefit not from sacrificing other people, but from peacefully coexisting with them and trading with them and marrying them, being friends with them.
So why can't we peacefully coexist with other living things?
Because
they don't have rights.
No, well, but they don't have rights for the same reason that you can't peacefully coexist with them, in the sense that you cannot just, if you, let's say, you're a farmer and you put no fences around your property and you say, okay, well, animals, you leave me my plot of land and I'll leave you yours. They'll overrun your property because they're not rational. They're predators, or they have no means of respecting property. And so it's your relationship. You have to choose, because you're not dealing with.
So because animals animals do recognize property rights. You'll find very, very, very clearly defined boundaries between one chipmunk's territory and another chipmunk's territory, for example. And if another chipmunk gets into that first chipmunk's territory, they'll start yelling and screaming. They make the loudest racket. If you'd ever lived in the woods, you'd know about this.
Okay, that is not the same.
They understand property rights. Well,
no, they don't understand property.
I'm saying animals have they respect the rights of each other. They define boundaries. They bond for lifetime. Many many mammals, many birds for that matter. And how can we just say all of that's irrelevant?
Whether they quote respect boundaries, and I think that's importing a human concept to animals. Whether they respect boundaries of each other, the question for me as a human is, what do they respect my boundaries, and can I peacefully coexist with them? And the answer is obviously not. If I cannot live next door to a lion and, you know, see him every morning as I pick up the paper and live securely because his goal is to eat me, that is, he's a predator. He's not a producer.
Well, actually, the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of people who live relatively close to lions, and by and large the lions don't attack them because lions really, you know, would rather not take on humans. It's not a battle that they usually win. They usually try and, you know, usually lions and bears for the same thing. I lived up in the woods in Vermont for a lot of years, and there were bears out in the woods behind my house. They didn't come near me because they didn't want to get shot.
Okay, but if you shot them, PETA would say that's wrong. That's a violation of their quote rights. And the point is, you can shoot them. When it comes you're making my point. I'm saying when it comes to a conflict between an animal's life and a human's life, the human has rights, the animal does not, and so you use the animal for your own benefit. By the principle that you're advocating, you should let the bear eat you because he's got a right to his own food,
I'm not suggesting that at all. But I think that there's a reasonable middle ground here. Anyhow.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Joni in Middle Mass is in the chat room. If you get to go to TomHartman.com and click on the chat room, it's talking about yowling with cats and howling with wolves. Steve had said, dogs have human owners, cats keep humans as pets. Which is true of my cats. They keep us, Louise and I, as pets. Pace Cop says, cats are Republicans? So it's great. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And John in Wayland, Michigan is on the line. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, I appreciate and love your show, Tom.
Well, thank you, John.
It's about time that we started getting some of this other side out, where instead of people just being propagandized by people like Rush Limbaugh. My main thing that I was concerned with, I wonder if the Catholics, especially this right wing, I believe, was it a bishop that you talked about earlier? I wonder if they realize that W, as an evangelical, quote unquote, considers Catholics to be pagans.
Yeah, I think that's particularly ironic. Yeah, the guy we were talking about was William Donahue. He's the head of the Catholic League. which he's kind of taken over, apparently. And, I'm not sure if W considers Catholics to be pagans, but certainly the church to which he belongs is of that position. Yeah.
I see. I suppose
so I'm not sure he's ever spoken out on it, personally.
Well, he wouldn't want to because it's all politics.
Yeah.
As evangelicals want to believe desperately that moving W in the warehouse was moving Jesus into the White House, Jesus wouldn't have attacked Iraq.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, who would Jesus bomb is a great bumper sticker.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you, John. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, and boy, a tough one. John in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, what's up, John?
Well, animals do have rights, Sam. Human beings are animals, as evidenced by the fact that we're very animalistic when we turn other people's neighborhoods into a war zone. And with regard to the religious position on war, in addition to the Catholic Church opposing the present war in Iraq before it started, the national leaders of nearly every American religious denomination in this country oppose the war, and that includes the one that Bush and Cheney are members of.
The Methodist Church.
Yeah, they wrote him a letter, you know, and said, don't go to war in Iraq. Now, this is in the category of suppressed news. It did get reported. For example, I saw it reported once on a mainstream network newscast, either by Peter Jennings or by Dan Rather, somebody like that. But news like this, which is very significant, you know, I mean, widespread religious opposition to war doesn't get repeated over and over and over again.
Well, particularly not by news organizations that are owned by big defense contractors.
Right. And, you know, nearly every American knows that an American teenager disappeared in some place called Aruba. Probably the majority of Americans may even know her first name. But how many people really know that there was widespread official religious opposition to the war in Iraq, you know? So
yeah, it's not happening. It's not happening. John, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And most Americans don't know it. And most Americans are clueless about it. It's a tragedy. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, I enjoyed that conversation you had with Randy in there. I guess the point I was thinking about is since their official worldview is atheistic, for them to say that the humans are any different qualitatively than animals is really kind of ridiculous because there's no spiritual component to people, according to them. So therefore, it's just a matter of us having a more highly developed central nervous system, and it's kind of the might makes right philosophy. And
but that's the core of conservative thinking. I mean, this is why.
Well, it's more Nazi-like, really.
Well, you know, no, I don't think so. I mean, the Nazis certainly adopted that philosophy, but I think that whole idea at the core of conservative thought that hierarchy is the appropriate way for things,
right,
and that power is the reflection of goodness and therefore deserves to perpetuate itself, and the same for wealth. You know, that has been at the core of conservative thought overtly all the way back, I mean, back to the founding of Mesopotamia by Gilgamesh or in the more recent conservative past, back to Sir Edmund Burke in the 1770s, you know, just overtly. So anyhow, Rick, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. But it's important that we visit these things and that we see the world through conservative eyes occasionally, but not too much. 29 minutes past.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Sometimes it's bad when the going gets tough. Yeah, we look in the mirror. Yeah, we wanna give up.
But you don't give up.
Sometimes you don't even want to try. Sometimes we cry.
And we keep on going. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception, where despair is not an option. You must get active. Ravi in Espanola, New Mexico. Am I pronouncing that right, Ravi?
Yeah.
Hey, Ravi. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How you doing? Yeah, I got kind of interested with a couple of the comments on oil earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you saw the BBC news on Chavez makes U.S. oil export threat.
No, I didn't. It's not the first time. If it's a recent threat, it's not the first time he's done that. He's been talking like that for about a year now.
Yeah, he had some run-in with the DEA spying on him, and
yeah, he just pulled out of the bilateral treaty that we had with Venezuela to do drug interdiction, and he suggested we're talking about Hugo Chavez, who's the president of Venezuela, who just won another re-election. And he suggested that most of our anti-drug activities in South America were covert attempts, thinly disguised attempts to actually manipulate the internal politics of the various countries in which we were, quote, fighting drugs, end quote, and that we actually had no intention of fighting drugs because we weren't stopping Americans from buying them.
Yeah, well, what really picked my attention on this article is I just got done reading Jared Diamond's Collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And there is.
Is that a good book?
Yeah.
And I read Guns, Germs, and Steel. I haven't had a chance to read Collapse yet.
Part of his thing is when a society's in their collapse phase, they have enemies and they have trading partners.
Right.
And so each can have its own influence.
Yes. That's true, and that's why China's no longer an enemy. They're the communist red China. They are a trading partner. Good point, Ravi. Thank you for calling and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, listening to Evan and coming from the perspective of someone who has a strong background in ethology, that is animal behavior.
Yeah, that wasn't Evan. That was Alex.
Alex, sorry.
Yeah.
First of all, you did very well, Tom. It was interesting. This is one of the disappointing things listening to someone like Alex, is that they don't know what they're talking about, and if you're going to be dealing with such a big issue, you should understand a bit of animal behavior. And
yeah,
actually, most
yeah.
of his arguments would actually support the animals over the humans.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
They're extremely territorial. They respect territory better than we do.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. I mean, I've actually lived out there in the woods with animals. I lived in a teepee for half a year once. They have territories. They absolutely have territories. And, you know, and anybody who's ever owned a dog knows that, you know, the dog, hey, this is my yard. Don't come near my yard. You know, it's they're very territorial.
Yeah, they have very structured societies. They have respect. They many of these things he might call, quote, an abstract concept. We're finding, you know, more and more that these things we thought separate us from the animals, the, quote, animals, of course, again, we are one, they're much more similar.
Yeah.
Especially if you look at, like, Mark Beckoff, a professor at the University of Colorado, a lot of what he's writing, The Smile of the Dolphin and so forth, it's really enlightening. We are not as different as we thought. A lot of these things, we're so reluctant to say that animals have, you know, these various aspects that we attribute only to humans. We're finding they're not even close.
No, we've
that
kind
the
of
animals do have. They do have these emotions. They do, in many cases, show even signs of having abstract concepts.
Oh, sure, sure. And we have reverse anthropomorphized. We've anti-anthropomorphized the animal kingdom to the extent that it's become pathological for us. Jeff,
yeah,
thank you for the call. I got to move along. I appreciate the call, though. But one of these days, I'll share with you my rant about democracy and Thomas Jefferson, which is a chapter in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, about how Jefferson was right about democracy in the animal kingdom and what it means for us. But not right now, because Alec Dubrow is with us. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, otherwise known as ILCA, I-L-C-A, online.org is their website, ILCAonline.org. And hey, Alec.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Great. Great to have you with us. We just had a guest from the other side of the track, as it were, a conservative on by the name of Alex. That's the fellow who our caller was talking about. He wasn't dissing you, so it's just so you know.
That's okay.
Yeah.
I'm not responsible for what any other Alex says. I'm barely responsible for what I say.
There
so.
You go. Well, we all do our best. Alec, in the last couple of weeks, we saw this big strike at Heathrow Airport.
Right.
And what boggled my mind about this was how terribly it was covered by the American press. Everybody in England, as far as I could tell from what little I was picking up of the European press and reading British newspapers, everybody understood the issues at stake here. An American company decided to just unilaterally fire some 500 or 600 people, and the workers of British Airways said, "Hey, you can't do that," and staged a arguably illegal or technically illegal. There's another word for it. perhaps
wildcat strike, walkout.
Walkout and said, you know, enough is enough already. And it was not covered in the American press that, number one, this was caused by an American company, and the Europeans were saying, hey, we don't do business that way here, and that, number two, there was some righteousness to it. Instead, the only thing that was covered was the disruption to travel.
Yeah, it was fascinating, because I do watch the BBC News, and I watch the American news, and it's quite true. And, I mean, it was one after another interview with understandably inconvenienced, angry, confused passengers. But, you know, on one hand, I'd be a little more sympathetic to them if they ever paid any attention to the people who work at minimum and sub-minimum wages to deliver what they need. And they only pay attention when something like this happens.
Yeah, I didn't see a single interview on the mainstream media, and maybe there were some out there. I mean, I can't claim to have watched all TV networks, but I didn't see a single interview at any time during the 3 or 4 days that this thing was playing out of any of the workers over Heathrow.
Oh, it's fascinating. Yeah, and it was a fairly homogenous group of Indian women. And it would have made great interviews because they were so colorful. They showed up in their saris, and they were chanting TNG Zindabad, which means long live TNG, transport and general workers, in Hindi. It was a great interview, the ones I saw. And another aspect to this is, yes, it was an American company, and they had brought an American manager over, but on Monday, the Daily Mirror reported, I don't know if you saw this, that a year ago, managers had drawn up a plan, and I'm quoting here from the New York Times, intended to provoke Heathrow employees into striking illegally so that they could be replaced by lower-wage workers. They had this plan. Several executives broke it.
The American companies had this plan.
Yeah, Gate Gourmet did. They Gate Gourmet responded and said, oh, yeah, it was on paper, but the previous managers had done it, and nobody had any intention of ever doing
this. So this was a year ago?
Yes. Yes, they had a plan in place to do that.
And then a year later, after the furor dies down about it being released, being leaked out, that they plan to provoke an illegal strike so they can fire all their workers, so that they can do like Reagan did with the air traffic controllers, basically.
Well exactly. And these people were making, I think the Wynn News just said $11 an hour. I'm not sure it was that high. It was £6.20 an hour. And Gate Gourmet said, I'm sorry, that's way too much. We're going to cut your wages. Understandably, this is an industry, the airline industry and its suppliers, who have problems, financial squeezes. Sure. But the idea that they can be solved by giving people substandard wages, removing their benefits, and treating them this way is not acceptable.
Yeah.
And one of the things is that, you know, consumers get very irritated at strikes. But what they don't understand, or most people don't understand, because they haven't been on a strike, haven't participated, and haven't even really seen very many of them, is what Harry Bridges, the militant longshore labor leader, said. The strike is the only weapon labor has. Ultimately, people say, well, why don't you negotiate? Well, you can only negotiate if you have something to bring to the table.
Right.
And what labor can bring to the table is its labor. Either they're going to do it or they're going to withhold it. Management has several things. They have the money. They have the power. They have the power to call in the authorities. Labor can only say, we're not going to work. We can't take it anymore.
Yeah, management can say, okay, we can negotiate. We'll have benefits. We'll not have benefits. We'll talk about health care. We'll talk about insurance. We'll talk about vacations. We'll talk about pensions, all these different things. The only thing, that's a really interesting concept. The only thing that labor can bring to the table is we'll work or we won't work.
That's unfortunately the case. And, you know, I mean, there's a long history to this. The word strike precedes the labor movement by at least 50, maybe 100 years. It's very interesting that when there was no organized labor in the United States or even in Europe at that time, the one place where people worked in groups and were interdependent, was on ships. And sometimes the sailors would say, we are not going to go out for these wages or to be whipped this way. And they said, that does it. We're striking the sails. And they struck the sails.
Which means bring down the sails, in nautical terms. Bring down the sails, stop the boat from moving.
That's right. It's not going anywhere.
Shut down the power source.
That's right. And that was a strike. And, you know,
I didn't know that's where the word came from. That's fascinating. You're a fountain of trivia here, Alec.
Oh, yeah. I actually played in a few trivia contests, but I lost when they asked me to name people from industrial basketball leagues. This stuff, however, I do know. Okay. And it's so interesting that people don't know it in large measure because, as you pointed out, the signal event was Reagan's firing of the air traffic controllers, but the extent of it, most people don't know. From the 50s to the 80s, labor averaged 400 strikes annually. And at the same time, it says labor unions made a number of impressive gains in terms of wages, health care, insurance, pension benefits through collective bargaining. After that,
even though during that same period of time, from the 50s to the 80s, there was a slow erosion of the percentage of labor, there was an increase in the total numbers of people who were working, who were covered by organized labor, collective bargaining agreements?
Number covered by collective bargaining agreements, but also, as we've noted before, other people who were not covered by collective bargaining agreements got the same thing because management was afraid that they would be unionized.
Right, but in 1950, you had about 35% of our workforce
unionized. That's right. It reached a high number at that point.
Right,
yes,
and in 1980, it was down to 25%. But the labor force grew. So did the absolute number of people who were members of unions from 1950 to 1980 actually increase as an absolute number, or did it also slightly decrease?
No, because the workforce grew so rapidly, in large part because the population grew, but also because so many women entered the workforce and immigration stepped up, that numbers are not significantly less. Percentages are, and what they call union density is way down.
Mm-hmm.
But also simply because strikes have been made essentially illegal.
Right.
And in 2003, the Bureau of Labor Statistics recorded only 14 strikes. That was down from 400 strikes.
When Reagan came into office?
Well, in the 50s to the 80s, all over. But, you know, if you take away the only weapon we have, then management can do as it will. And that we're seeing the effects of it. It's a tragedy. It's a loss. And the people who are temporarily inconvenienced ought to think about that once in a while. That, you might get this product a little bit cheaper, but ultimately, what are we losing with this?
Yeah, and it seems to me, Alec, that we're talking with Alec Dubrow, who's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org.
Yep.
And in the 2.5 minutes or so we have left here, Alec, it seems to me that given that the Bush administration has stacked the U.S. Department of Labor with people who hate labor, you know, who have
essentially
who have an anti-labor agenda, that a lot of states have been taken over by anti-labor agendas. Certainly, the corporate agenda has always been anti-labor. It seems to me that the only way to get this back is to elect progressive Democrats to office. And all across the United States. Is there any other solution? I mean, you call up your congressman and say repeal Taft-Hartley, but it's not going to happen.
Well, I think you're right. The question is which comes first, and maybe they proceed simultaneously. But social movements have often resulted ultimately in the electing of sympathetic officials. You know, if you begin to show enough power, power accretes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You get some here, then you'll get some there. It's, from the point of view of labor, the debate is whether we should be putting our resources into electing these people or building the movement in which people have to become responsive to it. So, Yes, we need interpretations of the law that are sympathetic to us, or at least adhere to the law, and we need to have legislators and executives who recognize the legitimacy of our power. But the question is, do you simply elect them, or do you elect them as a result of a social movement? And that's an argument that goes on to this day. In any case, we're going to proceed, and presumably, strikes will happen when they happen.
Yeah, and a good thing it is, frankly, mm-hmm. because that if there's strikes happening, that means labor is still alive, because that's, as you said, that's the only thing that they can bring to the table.
Exactly. And you know, I feel some sympathy for people who are stuck there, but gee, being stuck in London for a day and a half, is that the worst thing that's ever happened to you?
Yeah, compared to having to spend your life as a $5 an hour worker for an American food company.
Exactly.
Yeah. As essentially a minimum wage worker. Fascinating. You said power accretes. I've never heard that phrase before. Is that?
I just made it up on the spot. You force me into these things, Tom.
You do so good, Alec. I got to start writing this stuff down.
It's great.
It's
like sort of the opposite. You can't win for losing.
There you go. Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAOnline.org. Thanks a lot, Alec, for being with us today.
Take care, Tom.
I appreciate it. Thank you for your wisdom, as always. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What was it you wanted? Tell me again so I know. What's happening in there? What's going on in your show?
Welcome back.
What was it you wanted?
Here we go. You're in the middle of the real free speech zone. No press pass, no RNC pass required, no barbed wire around the outside. We won't haul you off if you have a No Blood for Oil bumper sticker, or even if you have a Bush-Cheney bumper sticker. Conservatives are welcome as well to our program. Welcome to call in and make your thoughts known. In fact, occasionally some brave soul will screw up enough courage to do it. They don't often last very long, but... Not that I cut them off, you know. No, I will give you your say, but you got to make sense. You got to make sense, and unfortunately, so very often, these cons just don't. Democrats for Life. Democrats for Life of America. It's democratsforlife.org. This is a group of Democrats who believe that the goal of society should be to minimize the number of abortions, which I think it's an admirable goal. I haven't, you know, thoroughly researched their website. I'm not sure if they are in favor of criminalizing abortion or not. I think not, but I may be wrong. But they have proposed what they call the 95-10 Initiative, comprehensive package of federal legislation and policy proposals to reduce the number of abortions by 95% over the next 10 years. That's something I think that anybody, no matter what their position is, would say, hey, good idea. Because, you know, as I've said before, I don't know anybody who is pro-abortion. It's a terrible, difficult decision to make, and one that, frankly, as a man, I can't even imagine what it must be like to make. This is why I've said many times I don't think that men should be allowed to vote on abortions. But in any case, they think that there should be full federal funding for toll-free numbers on contraception and support services for pregnant women to carry their children to term if they want to. Better adoption centers, a national study to update abortion data, federal funding for pregnancy education and prevention education. Gee, great. Abortion counseling and daycare on university campuses, federal funding for this to support pregnant women as well as women who may be considering an abortion. Provide accurate information to parents receiving a positive result from alpha fetoprotein tests. Make adoption tax credits permanent. Ban pregnancy as a pre-existing condition in the healthcare industry. Require adoption referral information. Women's right to know. Provide ultrasound equipment. Increase funding for domestic violence. Just a whole bunch of, I think, you know, fairly rational. There's so much that can be done short of criminalizing abortion to reduce abortion in the United States. Why is nobody out there saying, let's take these proactive steps? Well, I guess they were during the Clinton administration. It's just the Bush administration has rolled them all back. They don't want women to know about these things.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Bye.
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, a podcast on WhiteRoseSociety.org, and also on Apple's iTunes, and also on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Michael Powell, the former commissioner of the FCC, the guy that George W. Bush basically kicked out when his father, Colin Powell, had a falling out with the Bush administration. Michael Powell has moved on to classier digs, as they say. He is now working for one of the companies he once regulated. Jeff Chester is with us with the Center for Digital Democracy, democraticmedia.org, their website. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What are your thoughts on Michael Powell's golden revolving door here?
Well, for your listeners, if they're wondering, you know, why their cable television rates are so high, why there are just fewer owners of all the major newspapers and television stations and cable channels in the United States, if they're wondering why their phone bills are high, you have to look to the Federal Communications Commission. That's the government agency that's supposed to be a consumer watchdog and protect us. However, you know, each of the chairs of the Federal Communications Commission, including Michael Powell, go right from working for the public to lining their pockets, getting well-paid jobs with the very industries they once oversaw. Now, while Chairman Powell is not working directly for a company that he once regulated, he's working for one of the largest investment companies in the country, Providence Equity Partners of Rhode Island, that has major investments and does business in the very companies and issues that Powell once dealt with. So I guess the message is this is another example of government officials, frankly, you know, taking advantage of opportunities to line their pockets. And one questions, frankly, one has to say, they can't simply serve the public when they know that their next job is going to be with the very people they once oversaw.
Well, and really what we're seeing here, Jeff Chester, is it not the emergence of a new ruling class, a new class of robber barons? I mean, Michael Powell's father, Colin Powell, was on the board of directors of AOL, Time Warner.
He was on the board of, that's right, he was on the board of directors of AOL. And his son, despite the fact that we and others urged them to not do so, his son, when he was at the FCC, just a commissioner then, actually voted to approve the merger of AOL Time Warner, knowing that this deal would make his father, you know, lots of money, which it did. Yes, you are right. I mean, there's this kind of elite media class that benefits from the special interest policies they're able to get through the FCC or Congress. And the way they do it is they simply, you know, dig deep into their, you know, well-endowed pockets. And whether it's hiring, you know, former Congressman Billy Tozan, who once oversaw the pharmaceutical industry, to now be the chief lobbyist for Big Pharma, or hiring
for $2 million a year,
or hiring folks like Michael Powell or Reed Hundt or William Kennard, the Democratic former chair of the FCC who preceded Powell, they simply can buy whatever talent they need, and of course that gives them access, you know, to high-level contacts. That gives them access to tremendous insight.
This isn't limited to one party, by the way. If you, they rule.net, which is a great website for, you know, who's going, who's doing what, and which boards. You find that, you know, Sam Nunn is like at the, is at the nexus of so many corporate boards. It's just startling. The former Democratic senator from Georgia.
Both parties are equally as corrupt, although I think the Republicans sort of do it perhaps with more zeal. But if you look at the past numbers of Democratic and Republican FCC chairs, which I do in my website, you will see that regardless of political party, they've gone to work for the industry one way or another. And it's about time we, you know, raise opposition to this golden revolving door, slam it shut, and frankly force these officials to avow that they won't seek commercial employment, that they'll do public service. After all of these former chairs could write their own ticket at any kind of think tank and university, make a very, very handsome living, and not have to lobby for the big media companies they won't serve.
Yes and no. We're talking with Jeff Chester, the Center for Digital Democracy, democraticmedia.org is his website. Jeff, isn't it really, though, the case that because the corporate landscape has changed so much since Reagan came in and really started rewriting the rules of corporate governance, and you know, no longer enforcing the Sherman Act, for example, for all practical purposes, and abandoning most of the traditional rules of corporate governance, that we've seen this huge accretion of conglomeration of, you know, the emergence of monopolies for all practical purposes in every industry. I mean, you mentioned pharmaceuticals, you mentioned the media. It's not certainly limited to just those two. And as a result of that, you have industries that can, like with Billy Towson, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is paying him $2 million a year as a starting salary to be a lobbyist. This is the guy who shepherded the Medicare legislation through Congress as the congressman from, was it Louisiana, wasn't it, or Mississippi?
Louisiana,
who shepherded this thing through Congress that said that it was illegal for the federal government to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for lower prices. Now he's working for those pharmaceutical companies, $2 million a year. But the reality is that if Billy Towson had been forbidden from going to work for the pharmaceutical companies and had instead gone to a university, for example, that, you know, he wouldn't be looking at a $2 million a year salary. He might be looking, you know, at the high end at $125,000, $150,000 a year.
Well, that's right, but I think one can do very well on that kind of money. Look, you're absolutely right, Tom. We have developed these huge, powerful monopolies across all the major industries. The regulators are captured by the very industries that...
So shouldn't we be breaking up the monopolies? I mean, isn't that the place to start?
Well, I think one of the keys is to make sure that the lines of communication, because we're not talking about any old business, we're talking about the principal business that gives the American public their news and information. And already, very few companies, as your listeners know, control most of the newspapers, radio stations, broadcast television stations, cable and satellite channels. It's about to get even fewer because these big companies are now lobbying once again. So, Powell's revolving door is just an example of the corruption that permeates a lot of our official policy making in this country.
All right, but if we were to go back to the way it was in the United States for most of the history of this country, up until basically the Reagan presidency, up until the last 25 years more or less, where a good job in industry meant that you made 30 times more than the average working stiff, and a good job in academia meant you made typically 20 times at the very top. You know, in fact, a lot of universities capped it, that the highest paid job in the university could not be more than 20 times the lowest paid job. I believe that's the case in the military even to this day. It wouldn't have been that big a deal to say you can't go into private industry if you go to work for the government, because private industry didn't pay that much different, or they could have gone into some other industry or whatever. But
well, that's what the rule should be. You should be simply prohibited from working in, you know, the industries that you have oversaw for at least a reasonable period of time. I mean, I would prefer, frankly, a lifetime ban. But for a reasonable period of time, you should be prohibited. We'll eventually need legislation if that's even possible.
But then how do you get qualified, high-quality people into government service if they know that if they just bypass government service altogether and went right into industry, they could make a pile of money?
Well,
if they go into government service, they're condemning themselves to a lifetime of being in the middle class. And I realize, you know, a lot of folks would say, gee, I'd like to be condemned to a lifetime of $100,000 a year salary or whatever, the upper end of the middle class. But, somebody who has the earnings potential going to work for industry of millions of dollars, they view that as a negative.
Well, I understand that, but you know, but if they knew from the beginning they weren't going to be able to quickly sell out, and hope, you know, there are a lot of people. I mean, you have two Democrats on the FCC right now, and at least Michael Copps, probably wouldn't go into industry. It's not just because it's the end of his career. He has dedicated his life to public service. You have the former FCC, two FCC commissioners, one Gloria Tristani, who was on during the Clinton years. She went to work for a nonprofit, for a church organization. So you can get capable people who are willing to have a very comfortable, quote-unquote, middle-class life after their government
right.
service.
Right. So Jeff Chester with democraticmedia.org, it sounds like what you're suggesting is that the premise that underlies the question that I was asking a minute ago is wrong itself. That being that, by and large, if you want to have high-qualified people, you have to have high pay to get them. And the reality is that there always have been, there always will be, and there are today even, high-quality people who are sufficiently concerned about public service that they will set aside greed in exchange for comfort and go into public service, even if there are laws in place that prevent them from then selling out to the big corporations.
Absolutely, and I just want to recall for your listeners that when they think about Michael Powell, who is the man who promoted the idea that we should have fewer companies owning every piece of our media system, he had proposed the most outrageous, quote-unquote, deregulation of the media in decades. Let's remember that while he was making those proposals, probably in the back of his mind, he was thinking about his next job, and sure enough, he now has this clearly multi-million-dollar-a-year gig working to help, including on regulations, the very companies that he tried to help, frankly, as a public official. So the whole system stinks, and it's time for a change.
Yeah, and the change, at the very least, would include rules that say that the revolving door shall revolve no more. There is an absolute barrier being drawn between industry and government agencies that regulate industry, period, for life. And number two, breaking up some of these large monopolies.
Absolutely, and getting members of both parties, Democrats and Republicans, to appoint people to the FCC who don't come from industry necessarily, who don't see their their career with industry, but finding talented, dedicated people who want to do a good job and not just make a fast buck. Those people are out there, but oftentimes are ignored in the highest bidder takes all a culture of Washington, D.C.
Well, as a matter of fact, if we had rules like this in place, we might actually get more highly qualified people. That is not to say necessarily more numerically, but people who are more highly qualified coming into government service, because that would be the pool that you'd be drawing from, is just people who are interested in government service, and you wouldn't have to worry that you were that the pool of labor that you were drawing into government was contaminated by greedy folks like Michael Powell.
Absolutely, and as the media debate rages still in Washington, because there are proposals now that would allow once again few companies to control all the nation's media, we have to look at this issue of where these folks intend to go and how they ultimately are going to sell out the public interest.
And sell out the public interest they will, because they have been. They have been aggressively doing so ever since the Reagan presidency, and with increasing brazenness right up through today. Remarkable. Jeff Chester, you're doing great work there. Center for Digital Democracy, democraticmedia.org. How long have you guys been around?
We've been around since 1991, and before that, it was the Center for Media Education, which also did public interest work on media, telecommunications, and online privacy.
That's great. I recommend to my listeners, check it out, democraticmedia.org. We're talking with Jeff Chester. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
I do appreciate it. Great talking with you. It's a fascinating topic, fascinating subject, and some significant depth there. So, I mean, there's some real issues that really need to be brought up. If you want to bring these things up with your legislators, your members of the United States Senate or House of Representatives, you can call Congress toll-free at 1-877-SOB-USOB. It'll get you right through. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall. The cavalry was quiet except for the drilling in the wall.
And welcome back, my friends.
The curfew had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway, looking like the Jack of Hearts.
Yes, the old George Bush vacation song there, done by Bob Dylan 25 years ago. Welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, on the True People's Radio. Joe from Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I want to respond to that libertarian dude the last hour talking about animal rights.
For those folks who might have just tuned in, in the previous hour, we had interviewed a fellow from the Ayn Rand Institute, and he suggested that only human beings have any rights at all. Animals have no rights at all, period. There should not be anti-cruelty laws with regard to animals, period, and, et cetera. So there you go.
Yes, and I believe the philosophy that guy is putting forth is not only stupid and ignorant, it is also a dangerous concept because it's been a well-proven fact that a lot of your psychopaths and anti-social people start out to with cruelty towards animals
when
they're kids.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. In fact, that's one of the things you look out for with regard to serial killers. I mean, it's very, very common. You see George W. Bush, for example, when he was young, he used to put firecrackers in frogs and blow them up, and he thought that was very fun. That's the kind of behavior that indicates that you're possibly dealing with somebody with a sociopathic personality disorder, somebody who doesn't have the ability to empathize. My other concern, frankly, Joe, is that if we brutalize animals, This is my argument against capital punishment, too, for that matter. Even if you could argue that capital punishment reduces murder rates, for example, which some folks argue, I don't think successfully, but that's the argument they make. Even if you argue that, it brutalizes society when we intentionally kill. And it's like, Saudi society, one of the most brutal societies on earth, every Friday they have the public executions, the public beheadings in the soccer field in Riyadh. And I just think that brutalizes society. And if you allow the brutalization of humans and if you allow the brutalization of animals, I think it works its way down the food chain, as it were. It works its way down to humans being brutal to other humans. And we need to begin by setting an example with our animals. Joe, thank you a lot. Well, for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Ed in San Juan Capistrano. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, not much. It makes it easier for the rich to brutalize the poor.
Well, you're right. We're getting back to the Dickensian thinking, the Christmas Carol that Charles Dickens wrote, where, please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal? No, you may not. It'll cost me an extra pence.
Yep. What I wanted to call for, though, is this last guy, and you made the comment of where will we get people to work in government if we do this. It's just a
right,
question.
And then I corrected myself. I said the assumption is false.
Absolutely, because if you work, and this is just one company, and I know there's a lot of them out there, you signed a non-competition clause, and it's called Blockbuster. And there's people who work for Blockbuster who sign that you can't get hired unless you sign a clause saying you won't go to work for Hollywood Video within a year after you get hired.
Who's
more important here?
That's not at all uncommon, by the way. I have to say, in the morning I do a show for a Clear Channel station, and I believe that there was language to that effect in my contract with them. I think that that's fairly common, right across the board in this industry.
That you're not important, Tom, but who's more important? The guy that sells you the video, or the guy that's making your policy on your newspapers, radios, and television?
Yeah, so certainly the latter. Absolutely.
You think so?
Those
people selling videos are very important.
we gotta look out for that. We gotta
careful. Careful.
Yeah, there you go.
Vicious video people are on the move.
And radio talk show hosts I'm telling you, in a lot of industries, it's very common for there to be non-compete agreements.
Except for government.
So why can't we say the same thing in government? If you go to work for the FCC, you can't go to work in the industry that it regulates.
From your mouth to God's ears.
Yeah, there you go. Hopefully. Thanks a lot, Ed. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. That's common sense. And it used to be the way things were. We've actually in the past had laws like this. Most of them have been at a state level. I thought that there were federal laws like this. I'll have to look into that a little more thoroughly. But that said, you can't go to work for the industry that you regulate. We should just bring them back. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
So a new man in the White House with a familiar name said he had some fresh ideas, but it's worse now since he came from Texas to Washington.
It's worse now since he came. You got it, 25, 27, 26 minutes before the hour. My clock is getting screwy here. Whatever it is, 26 and a half minutes before the hour, I believe. There are 33 and a half minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. You're in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Our Washington Bureau Chief Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It looks like the Labor Department has finally admitted that the producer price index has now, because of the energy cost, jumped 1% in July. You can imagine if that continued at 1% a month, that would be
12%
a year. Can you imagine? Also, today,
and that's, by the way, that's just the producer price index is basically the raw materials number.
That's right. That doesn't even price turn it on to the consumer.
That's right. And you add on to those, you know, profit and distribution and everything else, and you know the PPI index, that index, some folks would suggest that you can take that and half again it or double it to get the actual consumer inflation numbers. So we could be looking at 20-25% inflation. I've been saying for a while now that that W here is going to bring us Nixon's economy back. We're going to be looking back just like it was in the 1970s. Gold is going to be at $1,000 an ounce. Housing is going to be in the toilet. You're going to have interest rates of 15-16% on home mortgages and gas shortages. And here we are. We're heading for it. I am convinced.
Sound familiar?
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, it was very interesting. Today, the NBC folks managed to get Matt Lauer, who flew to Baghdad with General Myers, who came in on a big surprise. And it's interesting. They are saying that essentially everything is on target, that they have that the domestic forces they're training will deny Iraq as a safe haven for terrorists. They said that they're going to get there. They said the insurgency that we fight day in, day out, it cannot sway us off the path. It won't be victorious, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so essentially they, you know, despite the fact that you had how many people killed today, they're in Iraq. General Myers is in Iraq, and absolutely nobody is coming off course.
Yeah, it's
nothing can get these guys to change.
It's really an old story, Ellen. You and I remember from when we were young.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Remember that?
Pay
no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Okay.
Sorry about that, Ellen. It was a little loud, wasn't it? But yeah, from The Wizard of Oz. I mean, this is it. We're in Oz.
That's right.
And the Bushies, you know, oh, everything's just fine in Iraq. I think, though, frankly, what's going to go on is that they are going to, they're ultimately going to take our advice. They're going to pull down the troops. They're going to declare victory and leave.
I think so. I think that's exactly what they're going to do. It's the only thing they can do.
They have to do that if Republicans...
And they should have done it 2 years ago.
Yeah. They never should have invaded in the first place.
Well, of course.
They have to do this if the Republicans are going to survive the 2006 election cycle.
Now, one other thing that's interesting is that, as you know, they want the White House and other people want there to be a Real ID Act, and this is coming up before Congress. Well, the state legislatures meeting very near where you are currently in Seattle are saying that this could cost like $100 million for the states to implement over the next 5 years, and that it could ultimately cost them between $9 and $13 billion.
I thought the Real ID Act had already been passed.
Well, this is their concern, is that the Real ID Act, it did become federal law it became federal law in Maine, and it was designed to, it has not yet come across all the states as I understand it. Maybe I'm...
No, I thought it got added to the either the omnibus budget bill or the military procurement, you know, the big authorization
did,
for the Pentagon.
It did, but I think they're only starting in one state. I don't think it is gone to every state yet.
So the individual states have to authorize it?
No, I think it's done, but I think that they are bringing it in slowly.
Oh,
in other words,
the feds are saying to the states, okay, you're next, and then you're next.
Exactly.
I
exactly.
See. Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, we'll have to learn a little more about that.
Yeah, it's unclear to me, but as I understand it, that's what's happening with that.
Because I had thought that the states had some period of time. I thought it was 18 to 24 months to comply, period, and that was it. And then everybody's got to have a driver's license.
No, I think it's coming in one state at a time over a period of certain years, and I think they're starting with, of course, the border states.
Right, okay.
And I may be wrong about that. Wouldn't be the first time I was wrong about
that. Well, we'll find out.
But I understand it.
We'll find out, yeah. Check it out and let us know.
Okay, one other kind of fun thing. You know what dumping steel has done to our economy. Well, apparently the Commerce Department today said that they're concerned about Brazil dumping orange juice. Now, no, this is not Anita Bryant. This is the country of Brazil.
Right.
And they are concerned that they're selling orange juice at the on the U.S. market below their production cost,
yeah,
just to wipe out U.S. competition.
Well, we do it with corn in South America and Central America. So
right, they're just paying us back.
Yeah, they figure pay, you know, turnaround is fair play. We do it with sugar as well, with corn syrup. Yeah, amazing. Okay.
And have you at all been talking about the Beverage Association doing a voluntary pullback at schools in terms of soft drinks that have sugar in them during school hours, but they'll still sell them after school?
Oh, geez. So, on a voluntary basis. Yeah, it's like the chemical industry in Texas cleaned up voluntarily when Bush changed the law so it was no longer mandatory, and all of a sudden they had the dirtiest air in the country.
Right.
Voluntary, exactly, and industry are not words that go together very well.
I would agree with you, yeah, 100%, my friend.
Okay. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service.
Washington.
Yeah, there you go. Ellen, thanks for the report.
You're welcome.
Great to hear from you today. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Billy in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Billy, welcome. What's up?
Hello there, old friend.
Hey.
Well, I wanted to agree with you and disagree with you, so I'll agree first, and then let's disagree.
Okay.
Of course you're right about Michael Powell and all of that crap, and we don't even have to go into it. Okay.
Okay. All right.
But, you know, I think that we've been drinking the Kool-Aid for so long that we don't even know it. And here's where I disagree with you. You were talking about some group that wants to lessen abortion. I'm the person who's going to disagree with that. Because let me tell you about where I think we should be at on abortion. It shouldn't be discussed. It shouldn't be in the public eye. It shouldn't have anything to do with politicians. It should be about families and doctors and no one else. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think that there's a public policy benefit to be derived from reducing the number of women who get pregnant and then terminate those pregnancies, purely as a medical thing. It's like there's a
That's
good...
not an abortion issue. It's a pregnancy issue. It's an aftercare issue. But let me tell you something. Really, if we could... the real message we should send to the people pushing abortion on us is, it's really none of your business. Mind your own damn business and back the F off.
Yeah, get out of our bedrooms. Yeah.
I mean, really, because, and that's the thing, they've been so successful, and this is what the right-wingers do. You know, they've got me believing there's a liberal media conspiracy. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know.
And here we are.
It's the liberal media conspiracy. Yeah, so really, I want you to think about the fact that maybe abortion shouldn't even be a public issue.
Yeah.
That those groups should be doing things like, yeah, offering counseling to people who are confused, guaranteeing to pay food and help. And you know, prenatal and postnatal,
or adopting children and committing to cover the total cost of survival for 18 years for them or 20 years.
And how about putting some money towards saving the thousands of children who die in Africa every day, live children?
Yeah.
So I have no respect for anybody who talks about abortion when they're not taking care of the live people.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not disagreeing with you, Billy. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ.
Hi, Tom. You know, last hour you had someone, one of the conservatives, calling Catholics pagans.
Yes, sir.
And I got to say, I agree with that. And I want to qualify that by saying that I am a pagan, and I mean that in the most complimentary and positive respect. You know, the Wiccan, I see a lot of pagan elements in Catholicism.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
We have the sacred oak, they have the cross, we have a goddess, they have Mary. At least one of our goddesses, Bridget, who was canonized, are holidays. Yule, we have Yule, and now they call it Christmas. Samhain became Halloween. And I guess what this brings up is, you know, Catholicism has always been colored by local traditions, wherever it goes.
Sure.
They've been very adaptable, and I think that's part of their success in getting their message out. And maybe there's a lesson in there for us progressives.
Okay. Well, yes and no. To the extent that you sacrifice your principles, you don't do that. But
yeah.
KJ, I think you're boy, I've got a terrible echo here, but I appreciate your call. To the extent that Catholicism has changed from original Christianity, yeah, hugely over the years. Hugely. I remember when I was living in Germany, learning how the Christmas tree came about. And it was an old German pagan tradition, and maybe not the technical modern pagan tracking back to Wiccan, but the old Germanic tribes, you know, long before Christianity came along. And every year, as the days got shorter and shorter and shorter, everybody would get nervous. You know, what happens if the sun goes out? Because, you know, people were used to having fires, you know, and you sit around the fire, and everybody knows the fires go out. What happens if the sun goes out, the big fire? And so And so somebody along the way figured out that they could build a little calendar by putting stones in a certain arrangement with regard to the stars, and that on the shortest day of the year, the sunlight would fall in a particular place, and on the longest day, it would fall in another place. And calendar stones like that are like Stonehenge, and there's more than 200 of them, actually, just in the New England states, from the Neolithic, that date back, thousands of years ago. And there's a whole society devoted to tracking them down. I've interviewed some of these folks on this program and seen some of these places, actually, in New England. But in any case, they figured out that there was a shortest day of the year, and then the days would get longer. But instead of telling all the people that, what they did was, as they built up to the shortest day of the year and people were getting more and more worried, the head priest or the head guy would say, okay, I'm going to reignite the sun. And so on the shortest day of the year, the winter equinox, which was typically December 23rd, December 24th, December 25th, right around in that period, he would go up on the top of the tallest hill and find the biggest tree and set that thing on fire that night, in a huge blazing fire. And everybody would stand around going, oh, ignite the sun, ignite the sun. And the next morning the sun would come up, and then the next day would be a little longer. The next day would be a little longer. The next day a little longer. The next day after that a little longer. And, a few weeks down the road, it's obvious the days are getting longer and longer. The sun's getting brighter and brighter. And all the people are going, he did it again, just like last year. Let's keep him in charge. And, it worked out pretty well. So the Christians came along and said, well, that's a pretty good tradition. We'll pick that one up. Gary in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just wanted to offer sort of a framework to think about the animal rights thing, because it seems to get people really confused. As with a lot of issues, people get hung up on the language of it, and the conservatives really take advantage of that. And so I just want to offer that, human rights, that's pretty easy to understand. What's the right thing to do with respect to treating other humans? And animal rights, you could say, well, what's the right thing to do with respect to treating animals? Now, the guy that you had on from the Ayn Rand Foundation or Society...
Institute,
I wish he was still on. I'd love to challenge him on this. He created the classic false dichotomy here. Either animals have absolutely no rights, or you have to give them the same rights or better rights than humans. For instance, he said if there was a lion there that wanted to eat you, well, if you believed in animal rights, you'd have to let him eat you because it was his right. I mean, that's ridiculous. Would you let a human cannibal eat you just because he wanted to eat you? Of course you wouldn't.
Right.
So there are rights dealing with animals. There are right ways and wrong ways to treat them. Would it be right to torture a caged lion? No, most people would agree that would be a wrong thing to do. But they get hung up by saying that lion has a right not to be tortured.
Yeah.
But rights are always balanced. Human rights are balanced, and we can balance human rights and animal rights.
This is
so
the...
Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say, Gary, is that what this does, and I think over time, my discussions with the folks from Ayn Rand, and they're a good bunch of people. I mean, their heart, I think, is in the right place. They want to create a better world.
They're sincere.
Yeah, and they are sincere, and they are true believers, and their theory has been picked up in large part by the libertarians. I mean, the libertarians are kind of an outgrowth of the objectivists in many ways, and the Ayn Rand folks. And the problem is that they are utopianists. They're utopianists just like the hardcore Marxists were, just like you find utopianists all over the place and who say, if we only all did this, then everything would be perfect. It's I'm sorry, we don't live in utopia, but there are...
Like all utopias, it breaks down at the extremes when you follow their logic extreme.
That's
so,
right.
Again, in that case, the idea is, listen, we don't want to torture lions because he does have some rights, but we don't let him eat us either because we have our rights.
Yeah.
And, whether you take it from a religious perspective that there are God-given rights, animals, under that scheme, depending on how you interpret it, they do have some rights. We're supposed to be good stewards of the earth. On the other hand, I'm pretty much a humanist. And from a humanist perspective, all rights are pretty much made up by humans to decide how to get along. And so, of course, we can make up rights animals.
I take it from a biological perspective. I see us as interdependent with nature. We do not exist separate from nature. We are part of nature. No matter how much we may drive around in cars and lock ourselves up in houses and worship gods in boxes, in churches and synagogues and whatnot, nonetheless, we are part of nature. And to the extent that we harm nature... we ultimately are harming ourselves, and we just have to acknowledge that. I think I take it from the biological point of view. It's like it's like if one organ in your body rises up and says that it's taking over, that's called cancer. You know, it's
absolutely
it's not a good thing. I mean, there's a consensus about that, and it's the same thing in the animal kingdom and or in all life. I mean, you know, typically you have homeostasis, you have balance between species, you have balance within species, you have balance between species, and it just makes common sense to me.
Absolutely, and you know the idea of the humane society. It's not an accident that we use the word humane to describe the kind and appropriate treatment of animals. Because the kinder and more appropriate, more careful we are in our treatment of the animals around us, the more humane we are and the more human we become.
Yeah.
So that's my perspective. You know, we have to keep a balance there. We can't give animals rights that are greater than our own and say, yeah, we got to let a lion eat us. But we don't put them in a cage and torture them either. So obviously there are right and wrong things to do. And for some reason, people have a problem with that.
Yep. Well said,
thanks,
Gary.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. Just as a note, Maureen Dowd today reporting, Mr. Bush said, I'm determined that life goes on. That was the senior Bush at the golf course as he had started the Iraq War in 1991, yelling at reporters. In fact, his son, George W., yelling at reporters to get out of their face because they were having their vacation.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the light surrounding you.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Carl Rove. John Ashcroft's role in the Karl Rove leak investigation is now under scrutiny. Murray Waas reported for the Village Voice over the weekend, this from the Karl Rove Truth Squad, that the behavior of John Ashcroft in the investigation has been under serious scrutiny within the Department of Justice. Apparently briefed on the particulars of the investigation. Keep in mind, Karl Rove managed John Ashcroft's campaign 15, 20 years ago. These guys have been buddies for two decades. Now you've got two Democratic members of Congress asking for an immediate investigation by the Department of Justice into John Ashcroft's role in all this. The plot thickens. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana on the line. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, what's going on, Tom? I'm sorry, I didn't let you answer. I asked you a question, I didn't let you answer.
That's okay, it was a rhetorical question.
Oh,
go
okay.
Ahead.
Well, then I'll rhetoric it.
your rhetoric time.
There's a magazine up there called 2600, and it's a quarterly magazine about hackers and hacking.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the writers and one of the radio producers of the show Off the Hook took out a web page and a Google ad about Covance. And like when people Google Covance, their website came up as a paid ad on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not only did Covance make Google take that off, but they also shut down 7 web pages, including his.
Wow.
And, it's just like people asking, Bush, if you're willing, this is such a noble cause, then why don't you send your daughters over? We need to ask the Covance people, if this is so good, then, bring in your pets and we'll test on them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I just do not understand where these
people are coming. Well, I would suggest, Sean, that probably Covance defended themselves by saying that these people were taking a whack at their reputation and that not providing them with an opportunity to respond, et cetera. There are limits on what you can say about other people. In this society, you can use satire.
They're huge. They've got much more of a media, outlet than we do.
Yeah, well, and that's the problem. Then they also have the power and the money and the lawyers to stop things, to stop discussion as well. There are some companies actually.
That's been happening a lot lately.
Yeah, I know. And in fact, one of the biggest offenders is actually an environmental or a company that sells itself as environmentally active, and they're really big at suing people who out them. And I'm not going to name that company for that reason. But I mean, there's a lot of that going on. There's the real lawsuit abuse in America right now, and it's a real problem around the country. Sean, thank you for the call. It's always great to hear from you. And thanks so much for being with us today. Thank you for the folks in our chat room for showing up, to Scott for engineering our program today, Scott Forrester, to Louise for producing it. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.